Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Cohen's Corner. And this week we have a really exciting guest that I'm very excited to talk to. I'm sure we're going to have a lot of fun with him. Mike Janella, who a lot of you are probably familiar with. If you frequent Citi Field, then you definitely have seen his face and have heard his voice. Mike Janella is a game day and digital host for the Mets. You can see him up on Citi Vision hosting during Mets games and also catch him on Mets social media channels interviewing players, alumni, and fans. And he's also a lifelong Mets fan himself, who has done a lot of different work on camera over the years before ending up in Flushing. So we're so excited to talk to him today as fellow Mets fans and also kind of interested in all the different cool things that he's done over the years. So Mike, first and foremost, thank you so much for joining us today on Cohen's Corner.
My pleasure. Anytime I can talk Mets 365 a year, I'm down. So happy to be here.
And as we, Jake and I were also just saying, you know, it seems like whenever there's no Mets news for like a day, I get a little suspicious. So certainly they're always interesting. They're never boring, even when they can be frustrating. So I'm sure you're very familiar with all of that as we are. I guess to start off our conversation today, we know that you are, you know, a Mets fan, have been a baseball fan, but I'm kind of interested to first hear about how you actually got started in your career path and the role of like digital hosting and all that. So maybe to start off, could you kind of walk us through, like, I guess what made you initially interested in that and maybe how that kind of related to how you became a baseball fan as well?
Yeah, it's a story how I got into the business that I've told a lot of times, because I do a lot of like speaking to young hosts and coaching and stuff. And it's all about finding your why and your passion and all that. And it came pretty coolly full circle this year because I got to meet the person who got me started in all this, and that's Bob Costas, who any baseball fan or sports fan will be familiar with. And I'm pretty sure it was him. In my mind, it's him, like in the retcon. But when I was like 7 or 8 years old, I was watching a baseball game, and I'm pretty sure it was Cal Ripken breaking Lou Gehrig's games played streak. And I'm pretty sure it was Bob Costas who said something like, you know, I can't believe that it's my job to be here to be a witness to amazing history like this. Like, I'd be here as a fan, and I get to be here working it. And something in my head clicked, like, wow, that's actually a pretty awesome way to look at it. And at the same time, my dream was to be a center fielder or second baseman, you know, for the Mets when I grew up, like a lot of young people's is. But I was also short and slow and not coordinated and very unathletic. So I knew playing baseball wouldn't be the thing that got me to the big leagues. But then once I heard that on TV, I was like, oh, if I can still go to games and like cover them or be a part of them somehow on the broadcast side, that seems like the next best thing. So that from a very young age just got me started on that track, doing student newspaper in high school and then TV club and going to Syracuse because I had to look up where Bob Costas and Mike Tirico and Marv Albert and all these guys went, and going there for broadcasting and then getting into, you know, sports jobs during school and after I graduated. And yeah, that's kind of how it all got started. And then Bob was at Citi Field this year doing a game of the Mets game for MLB Network. And through some favors I pulled that I now owe people big time, I got to meet him afterward and tell him that story. And it was really cool to just, you know, have that full circle moment. And even though I'm 1/100th as successful as him, he's the guy that got me started in what I'm doing.
That's awesome. Like, Bob Costas is the GOAT. We all know that when it comes to sports broadcasting. And you say that it came full circle for you kind of getting to meet him. Do you also consider it coming full circle since you've been so many other places so far in your career and now you're getting kind of, if it's your dream job working for the Mets, considering you grew up a Mets fan, like how's that experience been for you?
It's been amazing. And you're right. It's kind of weird too. I never thought I would get to work for the Mets as a kid because you have these dreams, but how realistic can they be? And it ended up, you know, coming true. My dad immigrated from Portugal in 72. And as a young kid, he was like 11 or 10. And to fit in, like the Mets, you know, that was the Tug McGraw, Tom Seaver, you gotta believe squad the next year in 73. So to fit in, he just became a Mets fan. Like, he learned baseball, didn't know anything about it, but that's what all the cool kids were doing. And then he passed it on to me, and I was born right before they won in 86. So he was like, oh, this is a good omen. My kid's gonna be a Mets fan for life, and it's been true. And it's been awesome because, you know, when I started getting into, you know, working in baseball, I was doing some collegiate leagues as summer internships, Cape Cod League, the Alaska League. I worked in the minors for a few years after that, some independent ball, some low A ball, like way down south. I ended up hosting a show for the Padres. That was my first major league break later on, but I never thought I'd be able to, you know, work for and be part of the team that I've been a fan of since literally I was born, when my dad was reading me box scores in the hospital as a baby. So And yeah, it's been awesome. And I pinch myself all the time that I get to be there at City for every home game and talk to some of these players that I grew up watching, talk to the players that we all watch and love now. So it's been, yeah, I mean, amazing. I know that's kind of the word for the franchise, but it's for how I feel about being part of it too.
So how did this gig for the Mets actually come about in terms of, was there a particular person who kind of pointed you towards it, or was it something you just kind of stumbled upon?
So I got started. Actually, my first exposure with them was 2016. And the way that the media business kind of works in New York, there's a lot of people like me who kind of freelance and work at a lot of the same places, and a lot of people that run in similar circles. So if you remember, if you're like a huge City Field fan, my predecessors there, mine and Emily Reppert, the current co-host of mine who were there, Neha Joy, who's now at Hollywood Reporter, Alexa Dadd, who went on to MLB Network, and then Brandon Wellington, who moved on to acting. And he was trying to balance his Mets work and his acting work at the time. And a mutual friend of ours in the business let me know that and said, hey, I can put you in touch with the people if you want to like be Brandon's backup kind of thing. And so he did. And I went in to audition for the Mets, and I ended up taking the job in San Diego instead, because it was my own talk show, which I got to do. But I felt weird to say no to the Mets, but I also couldn't say no to having my own cable talk show 7 days a week. And so I tried that, but the show got canceled after one season. And then I came back to New York, and Brandon ended up moving on from the Mets full time. And I stayed in touch with the Mets people because why not? And then they just brought me back in and auditioned again. And that's when we decided, yeah, let's make this thing happen and do it full time. And we've been doing that for 3 years now, which has been great.
All right. I have a City Field question for you. And this, I know it'll sound funny, but I'm dead serious. Has anyone ever beat the machine in those workout things? Because I've been to a ton of games at City Field, and I don't think I've seen someone beat the machine once. And I guess you see all of them. So
it has happened. And yeah, I'd see them because I'm at every single game, but you're right. It doesn't happen often, but I think this past year it happened. I'd say it maybe like a handful of times. So out of 81 games, probably happened like 5 or 6 times, which is a good success rate. It was interesting because this year, you know, with COVID protocols, we didn't want to bring the machines out every single time. So it was a pre-recorded video you had to beat, kind of like ghost mode on Mario Kart back in the day. And you had to beat the timing. But back in 2019, we had the machines there in person. And that was funny because I think the people get more intimidated. You show up and you see this hulking dude or this CrossFit champion woman. You're like, man, I got to go up against them. And I think it would freak people out more. I think they had a little bit more success this year because they were just there on their own. But yeah, it's happened not that often, but it happens once in a while.
I'm 100% positive I cannot beat the machine. I've never been featured on this particular challenge, but I'm pretty sure I could like take myself out of the running for that per year.
You know, it's a physical contest, and they're some of the most fit people in New York you have to go against. So I've always wanted to try it too, but I'm also a little bit scared that I would embarrass myself. So I think we can all agree it's not our forte. It's not our strong suit.
That might be a fun like reversal though. You know, the host becomes the contestant. I don't know. Maybe
and
for
the,
like
and
a
the, yeah, and the machine can host, or we can do like a back and forth. Yeah, it's a good like Freaky Friday thing. Maybe hey, for 2022, that could be something we think about.
So I guess you know, Jake was talking about kind of some of your I'd say quote unquote normal routine at City Field, which involves like hosting a lot of the pregame and in-game content. So maybe could you walk us through like how you kind of prepare or what like a normal day looks like for you at City Field? Obviously, I'm sure random things come up a lot, but how do you actually prepare for all of your pre-game and in-game responsibilities at the ballpark?
Yeah, so the in-game stuff, it tends to be, you know, you get comfortable with it. And so after a certain point, you know, before the season, we do a lot of prep to figure out what is our entertainment plan and strategy and, you know, in-game. And then the first homestand, basically, just like the players, you're getting your reps in, you're getting the rust out from spring training, and you get comfortable with it. So it's a lot of memorizing scripts and kind of learning the flow and how you want to present it and things like that. Where the big daily stuff goes on throughout the year is with our pregame coverage. So this year, both Emily and I each had our own pregame show as well, which would recap, you know, previous Mets games and give you like statistical analysis and some advanced metrics and doing replays and interviews and features and stuff like that. Because we wanted to give fans that kind of legitimate pregame show that you would get watching at home on SNY or ESPN, like a Baseball Tonight for a national game. We want to give that to you there at the park too. So that's where the bulk of the daily stuff happens. So I'll show up to a typical game, you know, 2.5 to 3 hours before first pitch and start scripting my show for that night, my pregame show. So working with my producer on what topics we're going to cover, maybe what stats we want to feature, working with our research assistants to, you know, if I'm like, oh, Pete Alonso hit a 476-foot homer last night, can you find me every homer of his that's gone over 465 feet here? And then like, I'll work that into the script and how we're going to work that. And then how do we get the replays for that and stuff like that? So yeah, then just working on that, basically, getting something to eat, putting my makeup on, getting in wardrobe and stuff like that, your typical pregame stuff for any on-air job. And then, yeah, we go live an hour before first pitch. And then once the game starts, then it's just kind of watching the game. And for me personally, I had hosted this year our post-game show on Twitter Spaces for the Mets account with fans calling in and stuff. So I'd be taking notes during the game and what do we want to talk about after the game? What are some notes? What are some stats? What are some trends? Things like that. So you go through the whole game. And then if the Mets won, we'd host that show after for about a half hour. And then I just head back home. So for a typical 7 p.m. first pitch, I'd be there anywhere between 4 and 4:30 and then get back home anywhere from, you know, 11:30 to midnight whenever the game would end. But yeah, it would just be pretty much that. And then as things pop up, there's a celebrity in town, you know, trying to do some content with them, or if there's an off day and we want to shoot some stuff around for the social media pages, things will pop up. But that ends up being kind of the routine for a typical day.
So do you get to, on like, obviously not a daily basis, but do you get to interact with players often at all? Like, and kind of, do you have any players that you love kind of interviewing because they'll give you a really good interview, or kind of hard to work with? Like, what have been your interactions kind of with the players on the team?
Yeah, this past year was extremely limited to the point that I don't think we did anything with active players just because of all the health and safety protocols with COVID. So they were, you know, tier one. I was maybe tier three or four. You know, they don't give the game day hosts that much access, MLB, that is. So this year it was very limited. Though now in the offseason, we are planning some things. I'm not going to give away anything yet, but we're hoping to get some stuff with some current guys working in the offseason that's in the book. So stay tuned. But in the past, I remember back in 2019 and the early parts of 2020 in the offseason before COVID hit, the two guys I remember loving getting to talk to were JD Davis and Dom Smith, because they kind of love each other. So we got to do some stuff together, like as a group, and they just are a comedy team on their own. But Dom is just amazing. And I think we talked about this a lot on our Twitter show this year. To a man, almost anyone I've ever gotten to interview actively on the team talks about Dom Smith and how much he's the heart and soul of that clubhouse. He's just someone that everyone gets along with. He's someone that can crack everybody up, and he's just the nicest guy. And so I'd say he's been, for me, I think the standout in terms of who I've been able to chat with at length in my time with the team. He's just awesome dude. Awesome dude.
JD and Dom really became kind of the face of quote unquote the Cookie Club over the last couple of years when they did the show with SNY, which especially, you know, in the few months of the pandemic when there was no baseball was a godsend for fans like me who are really just craving any content. So I know I always appreciate especially types of content that really show off players' personalities and are just fun and kind of embrace the fact that baseball is entertainment. And I think a lot of what you're doing is related to kind of highlighting that entertainment factor. Something else I was kind of thinking about too is, I know at least for me, a lot of I was telling Jake this a while ago, but so I went to 7 Mets games this year and they lost six of them, and three of the losses.
Your fault. You got to be watching more from home next year.
They were shut out. And so I did go to a couple of games like back to back. And I guess I'm wondering, especially after a game when I always appreciate, I think, how like upbeat everyone was, but sometimes there's like not that much good things happening on the field to like highlight the next day in a really fun manner. So I guess kudos to you for continuing to stay upbeat and kind of being that like upbeat face of the Mets when sometimes they're not doing too well on the field. In those instances when there's not a lot of like great on-field things to highlight, like what do you kind of look towards in terms of if there's not that many like notable stats from the previous game, how do you kind of keep inspiration for your content when maybe the team itself is not doing very well?
You get a lot of practice in this working in baseball because it's such a long season. Even the best team is going to lose, you know, 62 times a year, right? For a 100-win season. So it's something that I think is also baked into the culture of the sport that fans kind of know, all right, it's not all going to be rainbows and glitters, you know, 162 games of the year. But for me, there's always something to take, right? Even if a team gets shut out or no hit. I mean, who had a good at bat or who said something after the game that can encourage you moving forward? What did they learn from that experience? And it's always what's on the next day or what's coming up next. So even if there's nothing from the previous game that's that exciting to talk about, there's always something new coming up. So just
there's always another game the next day, I guess, to like
Know, turn the page and move it forward. That's the great thing about baseball. Whereas, you know, in the NFL, if your team's 0-11 and you got to sit with the latest loss for six more days until you get back on the field, that's a lot of time to be stewing in those juices, right? But for baseball, it's like, all right, maybe the Mets got shut out yesterday, but you know what? We got Stroman on the mound tomorrow. Or we got DeGrom on the mound tomorrow. Let's talk about that, right? Just what's more to look forward to? What's more to come? And that's kind of been a thing for me because I've worked in a lot of long seasons for teams of different sports and different levels where it hasn't been that successful, but you have to still be entertaining. And I personally, for me, I always just remind myself, hey, you're working in sports. Like you get to do this for a living that people want to do for fun. And even if it's not the most exciting or the most like compelling stuff, you got to make it entertaining because it's still in the end, entertainment, it's still sports. It's still, you're having a blast. I'm living my dream. So I think that's kind of baked into my DNA. And hopefully the enthusiasm comes across in all the stuff that I put out.
Yeah, I would say the enthusiasm definitely comes across. Some people you can tell, you know what I mean? Like if they're kind of faking it or like, but I can tell that even before like reading up on you and finding out things about you that it seemed like you were a Mets fan, you know what I mean? And I mean, you have to kind of make yourself seem that way, but it comes across every game when, like she said, if the Mets got shut out or they're playing horrible, you're still able to kind of try to find some positives. But this year with COVID going on and everything, and you touched on it a little bit, how things were different. There weren't so many positives when it came to, I guess, kind of working and adjusting and all this. What was your takeaway from it? And was it pretty frustrating for you at times having to adjust to different surroundings?
This past season, it was tricky. And the more I think about it, we really did a lot of changes throughout the year. At the beginning of the year, we had limited capacity, right? Like a lot of other stadiums did. We had to be fully masked at all times, even on camera. And if you talk to any person who talks into a microphone for a living, like wearing the mask makes it a lot harder. It's harder for you to speak. It's harder for the microphone to pick up what you're saying. If you're on camera, it kind of takes away half of your face.
You can't emote as much.
Yeah, exactly. Like I could be smiling and you have no idea. And that just changes the whole tenor of the sentence I'm trying to say. And we had, you know, very limited fans and I feed off that energy whenever it's a live crowd. So that was a tough start to the season. But then more and more people were allowed to come in. Finally, with the full capacity, was fantastic. We were able to go maskless, which was great. You know, I felt like I could see again. And so by the end of the season, or even by the middle part of the season, it felt like back to normal more so than it used to. And there were some of those nights where we had packed houses there, and it just felt right, you know, to get back to that. It just felt so gratifying and so it's just so overwhelming. So even this season, yeah, but it was the year before was what was trickiest because with the players playing, but with the stadium shut down, there was nothing for us to do. And trying to figure out, not just with the Mets, but the media industry at large, there were a few months there where I didn't work at all before media outlets kind of figured out how to do work from home or remote recording or things like that. And it was real tricky. So I hope for all of our sakes, for a million different reasons, we never go through anything like this pandemic again in our lifetimes, but like anybody, we just tried our best and kind of got through it as best we could. And hopefully it's all in the rearview mirror now.
You know, there's been a lot, I think a lot of teams and also just sports related entities have kind of beefed up their digital content and like remote / virtual content over the last couple of years, not only due to the pandemic, but also realizing that fans are really interested in watching like videos and like even like recorded interviews and all sorts of stuff with players or just whoever. So I think all that content is definitely moving in a good direction, even if hopefully we can keep doing things in person as much as possible. I kind of wanted to switch gears a teensy bit and just ask about, so, you know, obviously your job working at Citi Field, hosting these pregame and in-game content is, I'm sure, filled with all sorts of like interesting things that happen. So are there any particularly like wacky stories from your time working with the Mets or like kind of behind the scenes chaos that like fans wouldn't have been privy to that you'd be interested in sharing? Because I know I'm always curious about how what kinds of funny things go on in terms of, you know, either hosting or just working at the ballpark in general.
Yeah, I hear you. There was more wacky stuff back in 2019 because that's, you know, pre-COVID, we were running around the entire stadium to do a lot of our stuff. Whereas this year we were a bit more centrally localized and we would have celebrities come in and do stuff. I remember the first story that pops to my mind was the night that Jerry Seinfeld was there for Seinfeld night in 2019. And he was up in the SNY booth doing a couple innings. And then he was with us like filming some stuff and meeting some fans for autographs and like popping into a suite. I think he went over to the radio side. Then he was doing the tailgate trivia that we do with me, sitting in the back of a truck with a fan parked in the warning track in center field, like between the fifth and sixth innings. And just like the whole entourage moving around and trying to figure out, oh, is Jerry going to make it in time? And going, he and I under the tunnels behind center field of Citi Field, just like talking for 5 minutes about like his sneakers and just like comedy and being a Mets fan and weird things I would have never guessed. And then, you know, Jerry, you know, having this watch this Ford F-150 or whatever the truck was drive past him out onto center field. And it's like weird stuff like that, where there's so many logistical pieces that go into it. Or this year, the guys from Impractical Jokers were there, a show I've never watched, but evidently is the most popular show on television because they had a crowd of like 5,000 people following them literally everywhere they walked, to the point that like our camera guys couldn't get to where they had to be in time. And we had to like scramble a little bit in the middle of the game. But so that's kind of the bigger stuff. But then on a day-to-day basis, like any business, right, or any sports enterprise that's that big, there's so many moving parts. And our job is to make sure that everything still comes off smoothly. I think about, you know, going to a Broadway show and one of the actors may say that, yeah, I couldn't hear my notes or my pitch, but you would never tell because they still go on with the show and still do it. So I think of times where, like during one of my pregame shows, the battery on the iPad, that's my teleprompter, dies. And now I have to kind of just, you know, scramble for 5 minutes and ad lib until we get back online. Or, you know, my earpiece goes out and I don't know when the video that's playing is going to be over. So I have to be ready to jump in at any time. Or I think there was one time where we forgot to cut away from the camera and I had just finished my sentence thinking we were going to a video. And so I took a drink out of my water bottle, which was still on screen to the thousands of people that were there. And I just had to make a joke about that. Like, you know, stay hydrated. It gets hot out there, stuff like that. So little things that just always in any production are going to be small hiccups, but that's our job as professionals, is to make that part of the fun and just bounce back from that. And I take a lot of pride in being able to go with the craziness. And it's something that I actually enjoy, you know, more, is kind of seeing how weird things can get and how much cooler we can make it after the fact.
You touched on Jerry Seinfeld and getting to kind of interact with him. So I saw that when you were with the Padres, you got to interview Snoop Dogg. I just want to know how that was. And that must have been a very unique experience.
It was. I've been lucky to, you know, work with so many celebrities over the course of my career. And more times than not, they're great people. They're just chill people like us. And yeah, Snoop was interesting because we had our own studio there. So we were able to control like who comes in, who comes out. It wasn't out in the field and like millions of people there. And yet he still showed up with like a 30 person entourage somehow that were all taking pictures for social media and wanted to be involved. And a lot of people in the front office just that never stopped by the studio happened to be at the studio that day. Like how convenient to be there and try and say what's up to him. He was great. I mean, he's always down for a good interview. And it was me. My co-host was like in his 70s and we got Snoop to teach him like some hip hop slang and try and, you know, it's like getting your grandpa to try and learn some new slang. It's just funny, right? So he's a baseball fan, a sports fan in general. And he got to talk about some of the players he liked growing up, and he was throwing the first pitch out that day. So we had some fun with him about that. And very relaxed, I would say, if you get my drift with Snoop, you know, whatever he takes to get
extremely
in his like,
chill
mode. Extremely chill. Chill vibes only. But he was great. He was like down to like joke around and have fun. And for someone that famous who's done, I'm sure, literally 10,000 interviews at least in his career, he still gives you that good Snoop that you want for camera. So he was great off camera, on camera, and just like a really, really cool guy.
I also saw, this is slightly unbaseball related, and then I have another baseball question after that. I also saw that you used to work for the Guinness World Records. And like,
I did.
Which I thought, I didn't even know like that was a job. So that was really cool. So one thing really interested me about that. So Jake and I have done a lot of trivia on our show over, you know, the past year. And I personally am a really big fan of Jeopardy. So I kind of want to know, just selfishly, maybe like what it was like actually meeting Alex Trebek and what the exact circumstance of that was, because obviously there's, you know, I'm sure he's done a lot of interviews and stuff over the years, before his passing last year, but from all accounts, he seemed like a really wonderful person to interact with. So I'm kind of curious, like, how that came about for you in the context of your work with Guinness World Records.
See, I knew you were a cool person because I'm a Jeopardy nut myself. So I can just tell.
I watch that it every day, literally every day. Like, same, I will record it in my own apartment to watch it. So.
Yeah, if I missed it live, it's on the DVR as well. I catch up like before bed. The late, great Alex, he was awesome. So, I was a Guinness World Records traveling judge, basically. So for 5 years, I just traveled the world judging records, or if records were already broken, in Alex's case, going out there to give them their certificate if they were, you know, high profile enough. So the circumstance was, he was and still holds the record for the most episodes of the same game show hosted by the same person. So it used to be Bob Barker with The Price is Right, but then he retired. Alex kept going. He's got a big lead still, I think, over Pat Sajak is next for hosting the most episodes of the same show, Wheel of Fortune, obviously. And so Alex, we reached out to him, our PR team, like, hey, you've got this record. Would you be down to accept your certificate? And me, being the Jeopardy fanatic that I am, I begged and pleaded my boss. I was like, I have to be the person that goes out to give him this thing. And they sent me out there. So I got to go to a Jeopardy taping. It was a Tournament of Champions taping. I think this was 2014. So I got to see the best of the best from the audience going at it, which was amazing. Then I got to talk to Alex a little bit between the shows. And he was exactly what you think. Like, what you saw on the show is what you got in real life. He was like a little sarcastic, but very like well-meaning, down to make jokes, very self-deprecating, just a guy that he felt like someone that was in your life. Cause for people like you and me, he was part of our life, right? For half an hour every night since childhood for most of us. So to see him in person, it was very larger than life, but he too, we did an interview as well for like our social channels back then. And he was so gracious with his time and took some real time to give us legitimate, thoughtful answers, because he was somebody that I think put a lot of thought into everything that he did. Even when he was joking and being funny, there was always kind of that second layer to it, because he was just such a smart, well thought out person. So he was amazing. And I'm just glad, you know, I never made it onto the show as a contestant during his reign, obviously.
Though? Did you ever try out?
Oh, multiple times. Yeah. And I made it pretty far before, a couple rounds in, but I still haven't ever gotten the call. But if I couldn't be a contestant with him on the show, at least I got to meet him and be on the episode. Actually, they aired me giving him the certificate at the beginning of one of the shows. So for me, I got to be on Jeopardy in one way or another. And that was an absolute dream come true. It was so dope.
All right. So you didn't get to be a contestant on Jeopardy, but you did get to be a contestant on the $100,000. So why don't you kind of take us through that and your experience and tell us how well you did for the fans.
What it's like to win $150,000 on a game show, which must be a huge rush because, I've also taken the Jeopardy test a few times. I've never made it on. I have to like study more. So I know that there's like stuff I don't know. So I'm working on like my eventual game show debut, which may or may not happen, but you have already gotten it.
Spoiler alert. Like you said, I went on $100,000 pyramid and won $150,000, which there's a loophole in the name, but that's the maximum you can win. I also won an all expenses paid vacation for four to Yellowstone. So I'm the only person, I think, still in history of that show 5 years now that's won all the money and the vacation. So
where's
I'm patting myself
world record?
On the
Someone
back
has
there.
To give that to you now.
I know, right? Yeah, I should reach out to some of my old buddies there and give me something. No, it's different. So part of my job, you know, I'm a freelancer host. I've been my whole career. So you're always looking for your own opportunities. And on one of the job boards that I belong to, they had this casting call for Pyramid. And I guess they were looking for, you know, actors, actresses, hosts, people that are comfortable on camera, because you don't want someone to go on a game show and then just completely freeze up on national television. You want, you know, fun personalities. So that's the difference between Jeopardy and Pyramid and any other game show, is that Jeopardy, it's number one thing is, do you know the material? Everything else, it's, are you a fun person that America's going to like to watch on TV? So with Pyramid, it was just a lot like a long interview process and like learning about me and how I'd be on camera and what's my background, what's my story. And then I guess they liked me enough. And I started doing a lot of practice rounds over Skype at the time before Zoom came into our lives with the casting producers. And it got to a point where they said, all right, like, we're going to cast you this season. So come onto the taping day. And I actually didn't get to film the first day that I thought I was going to play. I was an alternate. And they didn't need the alternate. So I was super bummed. But then since I lived in the New York City area, I was local. They said, hey, do you want to just keep coming back as an alternate? And if we use you, we use you. If not, at least you get like a free day of snacks on ABC. I was like, yeah, sure. I had nothing else to do. I was unemployed at the time, so I kept going. But the second day I went back, somebody had to drop out, and I actually became the first game of the day. So I went from expecting not to play at all to, hey, 9 a.m., you're on stage. Like, get your suit and makeup and hair, and, like, you're out there. And it was, I mean, awesome. It was life-changing money, literally, because, like I said, I was unemployed at the time. I think for, like, 9 months, I couldn't find the job. I was applying for my life. And I almost took this job at the time, now that I look back on it, that I would have hated, would have taken me away from where I am now, and would have maybe precluded me from taking this Mets opportunity, which ended up being the dream of my life. So once I won that money, I knew, okay, now I can at least relax for a couple months and wait for the right opportunities to come to me. But the game show itself was amazing. I was on with Bobby Moynihan and John Lovitz were my celebrity partners. Michael Strahan's just such a cool guy. Super
fun.
We're
both Giants fans, so
yeah, same here. So even better. I told him thanks for the Super Bowl. And thanks for the money. Complete opposite of Alex Trebek, because Strahan's like the host of a party and he's, you know, dapping you up and cracking jokes and stuff. But yeah, it was a blast, and I couldn't believe it. It was super surreal. And then waiting those few months between the tape day and when it aired and keeping that secret was the hardest thing I ever had to do.
You couldn't tell anyone?
I told my parents and my brothers, and that was it. So
sworn to secrecy.
Yeah. Exactly. I figured if I can't trust them, then who can I trust in my life? But then, then it broke. And then when the check came, that's how you get the money there. They write you the check for one lump sum, and it showed up in the mail. And I opened it and taking it to the bank. It was like the most nervous I've ever been.
Oh, I'm sure.
I'm going to drop this paper. I'm going to lose it somehow. I put it like inside of a folder, inside of a binder, inside of a backpack.
A
inside, like, yeah, I had to drag that thing to Bank of America. And it was just like the weirdest experience of my life. But yeah, it was so fun. And every once in a while, I go back and watch the video just for a laugh because I think it's so funny now. But yeah, it was wild.
All right. So whenever we tweet out this episode, I've got to look up the video of you on Jeopardy and also the video of you on $100,000 pyramid. See, I'm not sure if that's on YouTube, but hopefully at least some footage of it is.
Yeah, I think the Jeopardy one is for sure. The pyramid, I don't know, because they may have to charge you to watch it on like Hulu or Amazon Prime or something. But yeah, the Jeopardy one, at least you can catch that one. I know it's out there.
We'll plug it regardless, wherever it happens to be.
Sweet. Appreciate
well.
It.
Well, congratulations for living out my game show dreams. Yeah, I also saw
your day will come. Your day will come.
Well, okay, so I've also been watching The Chase with Ken. Yep. I don't know if you've watched any of that with Ken Jennings, James Holzhauer, and Brad Rutter, and the original Chaser, Mark Labette. And I saw that they are apparently casting for season 3. So you may have inspired me to fill out whatever form is necessary. So anyone listening to this, if I end up on The Chase season 3 or 4 or 5, just know that the idea was born here.
And my advice to you, just be as big of a personality as you can be. Don't fake it because they can tell. But when you're doing these interviews, just take yourself and turn it up to 11 because they love that energy. So that's my one piece of advice to you.
All right. I've heard from an expert clearly of how to get onto a game show. So that's really good to know for me. Okay. So I think for like the last little bit of this episode, we're going to turn it to our favorite lovable losers, the New York Mets, who have, there's always stuff going on. And okay, I kind of want to talk about the biggest news of the week, obviously, which is Noah Syndergaard signing with the Los Angeles Angels. And so I want to ask like both of you, and then I'll share my thoughts. Like, what was kind of your first reaction when you heard this news? And then like, how are you feeling about it now? Because it's kind of, I know he didn't pitch the last couple of years, but it's kind of a big deal, I think. So maybe, Mike, you can go first, and then Jake, share, like, how you reacted when you first heard this news, and then, like, a couple days later, how you're feeling about it.
My first reaction was shock. I thought for sure he was going to be back at Citi next year. A lot of the comments he made, even at the end of the season, about how he couldn't picture not putting on the Mets uniform next year, and how the qualifying offer sounded like a, you know, great idea to him, and so then when I saw that, at first I didn't believe it. I thought it was one of those, you know, there's like the fake Ken Rosenthal Twitter accounts that always put out these
Jet
fake scoops.
Passing,
I thought,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like passing with 3 S's. And I'm like, no, that can't be right, right? And then as I'm scrolling through the timeline, the realization hit me. And yeah, I mean, it was shock, a little bit of sadness. You know, he wasn't homegrown per se. You know, we got him in that trade originally. But for all intents and purposes, he was, you know, a career Met. And I thought he was going to be that way at least through next year. And I think a lot of us were under the assumption that, you know, he worked so hard to come back. He looked good those 2 innings that he pitched at the end of the year, as much as you can take from a sample size that small. But I think a lot of us were under the assumption that, all right, next year we got Jake and Thor, and we'll see who else falls in line. But that's a great start, right? And all the memories from 2015, and even though we lost that wild card game in 2016, I remember watching that game with a Mets fan in San Diego and just everything he gave us against Bumgarner that night. I was ready for those days to come back again, and I just thought it was a foregone conclusion. So, you know, I can't blame him or any player for going where they want to go for whatever reasons they want to go there for. But I just wish he was still in orange and blue next year. It was shock a few days ago, and now I'm just kind of bummed. I hope the best for him as a person, but as a Mets fan, certainly, pretty bummed out.
I think that's the best way to put it, because I'm completely bummed out too. I mean, it sucks. I understand why they let him go, and I read today that Syndergaard didn't even really go back to the Mets with the same offer that the Angels had given him, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I even would have wanted to give him $21 million. I know it's not a big difference than the 18.4 qualifying offer, but for a guy that's only thrown two innings in the last 2 years, like, that's a big risk, and now they can use that in other ways, and they'll get the draft pick, whatever. But like you said, I mean, Syndergaard, yeah, he wasn't drafted by the Mets, but, I mean, he came up with them. They made that trade for him, and really – if you look back at that trade when they traded Dickey, Travis d'Arnaud was supposed to be the key of that trade. And it turned out, by far, Syndergaard ended up being the much more impactful player for the Mets. But, I mean, it sucks. And personally, I've only been to two Mets playoff games in my life. It was game two of the NLCS in 2015, which Syndergaard pitched against Arrieta, and the wild card game. So Syndergaard's pitched both those games. So, I mean, I love the guy. And he's a great Met, great follow on social media. And it just sucks because, like you said, Mike, we all thought he was coming back. I mean, he said how grateful he would be for the qualifying offer. He wasn't begging for it, but like, he was insinuating that he really wanted it, and how he said he was very confident in coming back. And yeah, I didn't think it was real either. And the people were tweeting out, well, the situation's still fluid. I'm like, yeah, well, he's still going to come back. Like, there's no way. And then it became official. And I was pretty pissed off when it first happened, but after seeing the video Syndergaard came out with, and
Haven't watched it. I'm sorry. I'm really salty.
I almost shed a tear watching it. I'm like, oh, you got to watch it. It's good.
And, yeah, it's nice. And anytime a player leaves a franchise, you hope that it's as nice of a split as possible. And you know, that video was a nice touch. And for him, like you said, he was the lottery ticket in that trade, right? And he ended up being the more lasting impression guy of that trade with the Mets. So. Yeah, tough to see him go. I was at that same game, that same NLCS game as you, Jake. That was my first Mets, or my second Mets playoff game ever, too. So
that was a great
game. We were connected before we even ever met here.
That was some game. I remember Murphy hit like a foul home run, and then maybe a pitch or two later hits a home run off area.
Yeah, and it was about like 28 degrees that night.
Oh, I remember so freezing cold, my man. Ass oh, my God.
The whole time. It was so worth it. So
it was so cold. Me and my mom, that's where I went with my mom. We were sitting in the right field corner, and I went to a couple weeks before that, they had a fleece blanket giveaway. I went with my cousins, and it was the night Scherzer threw his no-hitter. Mm. And that was the coldest game I've ever been to. We were in the uppers. But anyway, they gave away this blanket, so I brought that with me that game. And I was just wrapped like a mummy.
Smart man.
So cold that night. But thank God they won. That would have been horrible going to that.
It's funny. I feel like I was definitely in shock when I first read the news. Like, I thought it was like a prank or something. I don't know. It's not April Fool's Day, so I'm not sure why I thought it was a prank. And yeah, it's funny. It's like, I feel like I don't recall feeling however I'm feeling for like any other Mets player leaving. Like, it almost feels like this is going to sound like dumb, but it almost feels like he like broke up with us, because he like led us to believe that he was like coming back and like said all these nice things about how much he loved being in New York, constantly posting about stuff in New York on Instagram. Like, I don't know if you guys follow him on Instagram, but he's like always posting stuff around the city and how much he loves the city. And then he just like left. And so, I don't know. I'm sure I'll like be fine about it in a little bit, but I like unfollowed him on everything and like muted his name on Twitter because it
is like a breakup,
him.
Right?
That's now how I feel. I've never felt this way about any other Mets player leaving. Cause like when the Mets traded Harvey, and like, I loved Harvey when, you know, back in his heyday, but the Mets traded him. It's not like that split was like different somehow, even though he was also kind of had his moment in the sun for the Mets, obviously, for those couple years. I also feel like with Syndergaard, yeah, I mean, his last full season in 2019, you know, wasn't great. Admittedly, he had like a 4.2 ERA, which wasn't that good. But, well, a couple things. A, like you guys were saying, he started the last playoff game that the Mets had. So in our minds, like, the last Mets glory days, really, quote unquote, if you can call the wild card game a glory day, Syndergaard was like at the center of it. He won their only World Series game they've ever played at Citi Field. He had that, and I think because there's been so few really amazing moments since then, especially playoff moments, like, he's kind of just that image of like the Mets being successful, because he won their World Series game and pitch really well in the wild card game. And also I think he's such a unique personality that like it just all kind of the larger than life stuff he's done on, you know, he had like that Amazing Life series with SNY a few years ago, which I adored when he like, especially that first video when he like went around the city dressed as Thor. And I'm like, who, like, I feel like the Mets had never had a player like that. You know what I mean? Like no one dressing up in like a superhero costume walking around the city. I feel like he's just like a very dry sense of humor in all of his interviews. And yeah, kind of like a larger than life personality that in a different way than someone like Pete Alonso, who I feel like obviously has a big personality, but I don't know, somehow Syndergaard, well, A, he was there earlier, but B, just somehow different. Like, I don't know.
He was a lot more subtle with it. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
You
know, like,
on the open about it. Or the like the jabs at Trevor Bauer. Remember he posted that picture
last year. Well, and yeah.
He knew what Mets fans wanted, and he just, I feel like he always delivered.
That's the thing. I feel like he had I think he really connected with the fans. The fans really adored him and connected with him. I'm sure I'll like refollow him at some point, but I'm sorry. I'm still in like the early stages. So give me like a couple weeks. Yeah, I'm just sad. He was like one of my favorite players. And again, because the Mets haven't been like super good since he last started that wild card game. That's kind of the image we have.
And I think you touched on part of it too. Anytime and any athlete that's on the team that you root for, when you feel like they're letting you into a look at their, you know, their personal self, because so many athletes are, and rightfully so, pretty guarded. You only get what you get on press conferences or on the field, or, you know, their social media is very particularly curated, but it felt like Noah was somebody we all knew. It felt like he tweeted what he wanted to tweet, or he Instagrammed what he wanted to as a person, just like as a friend of ours. So I think anytime you do get let in by an athlete, a personality that big, you grow that extra connection, and saying goodbye that much tougher.
I'll watch the goodbye video I will watch it, but I was feeling very salty yesterday and decided not to. So did you ever interact with him while you have been working for the Mets?
No, I never had anything with him, unfortunately, because when I got there, we hadn't done much stuff with players like during the season 2019. And then once we started doing stuff with players, me personally, at least, he'd already gone in for his TJ at that point. So he was off, you know, rehabbing and all that stuff. So yeah, unfortunately, never had the chance to. And then this year we were kind of separated from the players altogether. So yeah, nothing personal that I ever got to do with him. But like you guys, just from a fan's perspective, I felt like I knew the guy, even if I never got to meet him.
Well, Mike, we can't thank you enough for coming on with us this week. This is a lot of fun to kind of get to know you. We see you at Citi Field all the time, and to kind of just find out the person you are, this is so much fun. So we can't thank you enough for coming on with us this week.
Oh, thank you guys. It's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for inviting me on. It's always fun to talk about me, but also to talk about Mets baseball with other like-minded fans. So if we ever do a spin-off show that's just like a game show podcast, I'll come back on that and chat with you guys too. But otherwise, I'll see you at Citi next summer.
Oh, definitely. One final question. How do you choose the fans for the tailgate trivia? Because I feel like a lot of times they aren't that good. Like they don't answer the questions right.
It's not in my hands, to be honest. By the time I get to the truck that we ask the questions on, the contestants already been chosen.
Oh, okay.
I think it's a combination of either maybe season ticket holders or people that get there like early to the truck, like before the game, and they talk to the people that are watching the truck, like, hey, do you have anyone signed up for today? I'd love to volunteer.
All right.
So yeah, I think it's kind of a hodgepodge. Sometimes they just look for fans that, I don't know, are wearing a lot of Mets gear, and it's like, oh, you look like you know what you're talking about with the Mets. Why don't you come over? So there's no like tried or true way, but if my advice for that is just, yeah, look for the people that are wearing, you know, the Perk Patrol stuff as early as you can, anytime you go for a game, and ask them if they have anything available that night.
I got to get on there at some point, because I'm always like, I was going to a game once and they didn't know like someone's number or something. It was like, they didn't know. I forget. It was like Mike Piazza. They like didn't know he was number 31 or something along those lines. And I was like, what? And so anyway.
It's interesting. And it's kind of like a generational divide thing too. You see a lot of fans that are a little younger now, and they only know like the Mets from like the David Wright, Jose Reyes era on, right? Even like the Subway Series team, which that was my team, right? But for some people that's already ancient history, which scares the hell out of me. But yeah, it's funny stuff. But yeah, hopefully you get your shot next year. It'll be like your mini Mets game show.
There we go.
Practice for the
yeah,
chase.
Jake and I, we will both try to get on tailgate trivia at some point.
That'd be so cool.
At some point next season. I think that'll be our collective goal. Well, anyway, yeah, like Jake said, thank you so much for coming on, Mike. Before we let you go, is there anything in particular you'd like to plug, whether it's, I know you have your own website and your own like media coaching business, as well as your Twitter. So feel free to let our listeners know kind of where they can find you online.
Yeah, definitely. Social media, it's at Mike Janella, J-A-N-E-L-A on Twitter and Instagram. And then, yeah, I launched the business during the pandemic, coaching aspiring hosts. So if you know anybody that wants to be a professional television host, radio host, podcaster, sports reporter, whatever, I've worked with a lot of clients, you know, people in college, soon thereafter, just trying to give the advice that I wish I had gotten at that stage and working with people one-on-one to get them where they want to be. So I've done a lot, I've learned a lot, and I'm just looking to pay it forward. So that is MikeJanellaMedia.com. Hopefully you check it out, or someone you know, you can tell them about it. So thanks, guys.
Thanks for coming on, Mike. And as always, let's go Mets.
That's it.